In the wonderful Psalm 8, that was our first reading, we find both a sense of awe and joyful wonder at the mystery of God and of the glorious cosmos, the heavens that he's made, but also the strange and paradoxical nature of humanity within the cosmos. If you want to look back at those words in Psalm 8, O Lord, our governor, or our Lord, how glorious is your name in all the earth, in all the world. Your majesty above the heavens is praised out of the mouths of babes at the breast. So the God of the cosmos is a God of paradox. His glory and majesty are greater than all of the glory of the heavens, and yet his praises are mouthed in the cradle, in the nursery. Out of all the paradoxes and mysteries of creation, this psalm highlights the mystery of what it means to be human. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have ordained, what is man that you should be mindful of him? The son of man that you seek him out? Or in another translation, that you care for him? What does it mean to be human? What is it about being human that is special? Why should you care about human beings, O majestic God of the cosmos? Although the psalmist was overawed at the majesty of the night sky, he had no inkling of quite how vast the universe was. It was not until the Copernican Revolution of the 16th century that the Earth was displaced from the center of the universe to becoming just circulating a star. And gradually, it became shockingly apparent that the Sun was just an ordinary star and one amongst more than 100 billion stars in the galaxy. And then in the 1920s, there was a further shock, because Edwin Hubble and other astronomers established that our galaxy was just one of more than 100 billion galaxies. And just recently, we've seen mind-blowing images from the newly launched James Webb Telescope, which seems to be demonstrating that the universe is even larger and even stranger than astronomers used to think. So in the light of modern cosmology, the psalmist's question is even stranger and more poignant. What is man? What does it mean to be human? Surely the ancient idea that to be human is somehow special has been put to death once and for all by the discoveries of science. The philosopher Bertrand Russell wrote an essay called The Theologian's Nightmare, in which a theologian dreams he dies and asks admission to heaven. I ask admission, he said, because I was a good man and devoted my life to the glory of God. And the janitor at the door says, man, what is that? And how could such a funny little creature as you do anything to promote the glory of God? Dr. Thaddeus was astonished. You surely cannot be ignorant of man. You must be aware that man is the supreme work of the Creator. As to that, says the man at the door, I'm sorry to hurt your feelings, but what you're saying is news to me. I doubt if anybody up here has ever even heard this thing you call man. And so the libraries of heaven are investigated. Where do you come from? The earth. What is the earth? It's a planet. Where is it? Well, it goes round a star. And where's the star? Well, it's in the Milky Way. Well, we've never heard of that. What's the Milky Way? It's a galaxy. Oh, I see. Well, of course, there are an awful lot of galaxies. And after exhaustive research in the libraries of heaven, eventually the answer comes out, we're sorry to tell you that, and this is Bertrand Russell's words, man is an infinitesimal animalcule on a tiny body revolving round an insignificant member of a collection of 300 billion stars, which is only one of many billions of such collections. And so Bertrand Russell assumes it's the theologian's nightmare. And yet, this pathetic and insignificant human organism is one who looks, who perceives, who interrogates, who reflects. Look at Psalm again, verse 4. When I consider your heavens, it's only human beings who look and ask the question, why? And it is the pitiful human organism who has the audacity to address his creator as you. In humanity, in this pathetic, hairless, bipedal, carbon-based organism, the universe has become conscious of itself. And the universe has become conscious of its creator. And one of the strange things about science, which scientists actually find extraordinarily hard to explain, is why is science, modern science, so amazingly successful? To scientists themselves, that's a huge mystery. Because there seems to be a strange correspondence between the mind of Homo sapiens and the universe itself. How else could human science and scientific research and cosmology have been so unexpectedly successful? In 2004, NASA launched a satellite to test Einstein's general theory of relativity. It used 4 ultra-precise gyroscopes. Apparently, they were the most mechanically accurate spheres ever manufactured in the history of humanity. And they were created to measure what's called the geodetic effect, which, as you all know, is it's the warping of space and time around a gravitational body, and what's called frame dragging, because according to Einstein's weird equations, space and time is actually twisted and warped by a gravitational body, and therefore space and time is actually being continuously twisted and warped by the Earth as it rotates through space. And the satellite was sent up in order to test whether these weird equations, which had come out of Einstein's brain, were actually true. And according to calculations from Einstein's theory, the twisting of space-time should cause these ultra-precise gyroscopes to twist by a grand total of 0.041 arc seconds. And as you all know, an arc second is 1/3600th of a degree. And after years of work and more than 100 scientists and millions of dollars of money, the conclusion was that the gyroscopes twisted by exactly the amount that Einstein's theories predicted. Don't you think that's a bit strange? Why on earth should a highly complex and abstract equation, which is invented by the brain of a pathetic carbon-based organism, that infinitesimal animalcule, turn out to describe with astonishing accuracy the fundamental nature of reality and the utterly counterintuitive way in which space and time is twisted? Not only that, but the same pathetic species, Homo sapiens, is capable of creating out of nothing and designing an extraordinarily sophisticated experiment that fires a specially designed satellite into orbit in order to test and verify those equations. Doesn't that strike you as a bit strange? There is a strangeness about our species which traditional naturalistic accounts of human origins struggles to explain. You all know the story. Humans are merely the product of blind chance, meaningless processes, a bit of central nervous system mutation, a bit of extra brain cells and connections here, And this helps us to have a survival advantage on the African savanna. Well, that might explain how humans are better at searching for berries or hunting for antelopes. But does that explanation really explain what's it got to do with general relativity and the equations that describe the ultimate nature of space-time and the astonishing inventiveness and creativity to mount a successful scientific experiment? In this psalm, there is an alternative narrative for why human beings are unique. In verse 6, it says, "You have made him little lower than the angels." But I have it on good authority that one literal reading of the Hebrew is, you have made man lacking a very little of God. You have made man lacking a very little of God and crowned him with glory and honor. In other words, human beings, in all their fragility and dependence and weakness, are still lacking a very little of God. They bear the divine image and they're given godlike responsibilities. And I believe it is this which explains the remarkable connection between the human mind and the vast universe out there. When the great astronomer Johannes Kepler came up with his equations of planetary motion, he said, I am thinking God's thoughts after him. My tiny and limited mind is capable of understanding and following the mind that conceived and created the cosmos. Why? Because I'm made in God's image. And my mind is capable in some small way of reflecting the mind of the Creator. And that's the ultimate explanation for why modern science has been so unbelievably successful. But in the gospel reading, which we've just heard from John chapter 1, the paradox is pushed yet further, because the divine word, the Logos, the ultimate reflection of the Father's glory, became flesh. In fact, it's exactly the same Greek word for meat. God turns himself into meat. I mean, it's scandalous. You know, the first hearers of the gospel must have been shocked at that idea that the divine Logos might become flesh and lived among us. In other words, the God of the universe, the God of the 100 billion galaxies and so on, that God chose to turn himself into one of these pathetic, hairless, bipedal, carbon-based organisms, one of those infinitesimal animalcules. And if that strikes you as bizarre and incredible, I can assure you that the first century hearers of the gospel thought just the same. And yet, this extraordinary and unlikely belief has inspired and motivated the first century Christian church, just as it continues to inspire Christian believers and Christian scientists across the world 2,000 years later. And the second reading from the book of Romans takes our understanding of the cosmos one step further into the future. Because what the cosmologists tell us is that the universe is heading downhill, a long, slow increase in chaos and disorder, what the scientists call entropy, is slowly and slowly increasing. And eventually, there's going to be a slow extinction when every star has burnt itself out completely, and the expanding universe continues to stretch out to infinity. And they call this the heat death of the universe. And it's a pretty depressing prospect. This is the way the universe will end, not with a bang, but with a whimper. But Paul sees a far more wonderful and glorious future. The entire creation, including the entire cosmos, is groaning, not in despair, but in hope. It will be set free from its bondage to decay, and we might add to the heat death of the universe. It will ultimately be transformed by God's power into a new heaven and a new earth. And astonishingly, we humans too will be redeemed and transformed along with the new cosmos. So as I close, the mystery remains. What does it mean to be human? It's a question that echoes through history. It has particular resonance in the light of recent developments in human genetics, in biotechnology, in neuroscience, in artificial intelligence. If you're interested in some of those questions, I invite you to stay on afterwards and be happy to be involved in a discussion about that. Are we simply primates with a bit of an expanded part of brain, our prefrontal cortex? Or are we information processing machines, computers made out of meat, as opposed to being made out of silicon? In my own clinical practice as a doctor, as a neonatologist, forced to make clinical decisions about starting or stopping powerful life support technology in desperately sick and vulnerable newborn babies, these abstract, philosophical discussions take on a real practical relevance. What is the significance of a human life, especially a life that's at the margins of existence? As a baby doctor, I've often reflected on the strange words in verse 2 in this psalm, which says in another translation, out of the mouths of babes and infants, you have established strength. And so the brief and profound psalm comes to its final stanza. The paradoxes are not resolved, but simply restated. The God of the universe is known, addressed, and worshipped by this infinitesimal animalcule. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth.